Thank you very much, Phil. Our next speaker is Dr. Ed Farley. Ed is the program manager for the Ecosystem Monitoring and Assessment Program at the NOAA Alaska Fisheries Science Center. Ed's current research examines the impact of climate change and variability on fish fitness and survival during critical life history stages. The title of his talk today is Insights into Salmon Ecology and Production Dynamics Through Nearshore Marine Surveys. And Ed, the microphone is yours. Please remember, folks, to identify yourself for the people who are listening online since they can't see you. Thanks.
Well, good morning. Thank you, Eric, for that introduction. Get to the slideshow here. So I'm going to be presenting quite a bit of research that's done by a lot of different people, that some of them are included on the panel here. And as Phil Mundy mentioned early in his presentation, we actually started some of the marine research in the Gulf of Alaska, but we moved over into the Bering Sea based on a declaration of disaster back in 1997. It was by Secretary Daley. And Secretary quotes that the Bristol Bay Kuskokwim salmon failure is a glaring example of how important environment is to a healthy economy, and we need to improve our knowledge of how climate changes impact the health of our coastal resources in order to ensure their preservation. So after that declaration, a couple of years later, we were able to gain funding and begin research on juvenile salmon ecology in western Alaska. So this is a little bit of a history on how this took place. Our research occurred in late summer and fall, and as Phil pointed out, we have these two critical periods for salmon in that first year, right around the first 40 days when they first enter the marine environment, and then that second critical period, which occurs in winter, which we believe is related to size and energetic status that they gain over summer. The goal of our research is to determine the impact of climate variability and change on the early marine ecology of juvenile western Alaska salmon. And that started, again, in 1999 with a limited survey. It was a pilot study in the Bristol Bay area, the southern Bering Sea, right along the Alaska Peninsula, following some of the work that our colleagues, Dick Strady, had done back in the 70s. Based on the information from that, we expanded the survey into more of a systematic grid. Starting in 2000 and 2001, we began doing this area right here. Again, this was primarily focused on the southeastern Bering Sea region, Bristol Bay sockeye salmon. And then in 2002, we partnered with international community within the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission and started a research program called the Bering Aleutian Salmon International Survey. And with that, we were able to gain funding to increase the survey area pretty much to what you're seeing here. And all these little dots that you see on this map over here are actually stations that we occupy where we collect information on fish and on oceanographic characteristics. Now, through the time that we've been out there doing this work, we've had various partners helping us out with some of the research effort, including Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim Sustainable Salmon Initiative. Phil Mundy described the work that was funded by the North Pacific Research Board. That was quite a bit of effort going out there trying to connect physics to fish. And even more recently, we've had help with some of the research in the northern Bering Sea region off the Yukon from Arctic Yukon Kuskokwim Sustainable Salmon Initiative and the Alaska Sustainable Salmon Fund. And then this year we had an opportunity to get funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program and the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management, and that's a partnership with the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So I'm structuring my talk. You see that we've got this dark line right here. We pretty much understand this. There's a lot of different physics going on up here in the northeastern Bering Sea that I'm not going to be able to get into, that are much different than what are going on down here in the southeastern Bering Sea. So I'm going to give you a couple examples of the information of our what Phil called autonomous vehicles, the juvenile salmon, which are essentially the Chinook salmon off the Yukon, which I'll show you up here, and then I've got information on Bristol Bay sockeye salmon, which I'll show you down here to compare and contrast what we've seen. So we, at every one of those stations out there, we do some sampling, and what we're doing is a net sample. We're using a rope trawl to get the juvenile salmon in order to take a look at what is going on with them, and this is back in the mid-1990s, we did some gear trial experiments in the open ocean to determine what was the best way to catch juvenile salmon in the ocean, and the rope trawl was actually the one that won out. And in fact, a lot of the folks that help us out in our international research, like our Russian colleagues, Canadian colleagues, and Japanese colleagues, also use rope trawls to catch salmon in the ocean. And along with that rope trawl and net sampling for fish, we're also collecting the ecosystem indicators, which are physical oceanography. We do a conductivity, temperature at depth. We use a device, a conductivity, temperature at depth device at each one of those stations to get the temperature and salinity and vertical profiles. We also collect information on biological oceanography. And what I mean by that is we get phytoplankton information, which is the base of the food chain. We get information on the zooplankton species, which includes the zooplankton composition and biomass. And that's a really important component of what we're doing, because that information can be used to look at the prey quality, quantity, that's available to the fish that are out in the ocean, and also lead us into modeling, bioenergetic modeling, later on down the road. And along with that, we're getting information on the fish, which includes distribution. You know, are we actually sampling through the population? We get relative abundance. As Phil pointed out, the Southeast Coastal Monitoring gets the same relative abundance index, and they're able to connect that to adult returns for juvenile pink salmon in Southeast Alaska 1 year later. So can we do that with the Chinook and the sockeye that we see out in the ocean? We're also getting information on fish diet. That's another important component of this research. We want to know what these fish are eating while they're out there, because we want to know if they're eating high-quality prey. And also determining what they feed upon helps us, again, with some of the modeling efforts that I'm going to suggest needs to be done later on. And, of course, we're out there looking at these critical periods in size, and energetic status is an important component then of that research. So Phil talked about ecosystem productivity and how ice retreat and extent in winter on the eastern Bering Sea shelf can affect that productivity. Ice extent and retreat is highly correlated with sea surface temperatures in the spring. And what I've done here is I've given you some anomalous spring temperature data that was taken from the Bering Climate NOAA.gov website. This is for this goes back quite a ways in time, so I'm just giving you a snapshot of what we actually sampled through. Remember, we started in 1999 with our surveys in the eastern Bering Sea, and at that time it was anomalously cold out there in the waters that we were doing sampling. As we continued to do our sampling, it warmed up in 2002 through 2005. There was anomalously warm out there, and so we were able to capture another period that may affect our salmon. And then, as most Alaskans know, it got cold again starting in 2006, and in fact it's been very cold in the Bering Sea, Western Alaska region, all the way up until 2012. The data just go through 2010. So I'm going to give you some examples of what we've been seeing out there then. Juvenile Chinook distribution, I'm primarily going to focus on that northeastern Bering Sea, which is the Yukon River. So I'm going to start with the Chinook. A lot of this work is done by Jim Murphy and others at our lab. So what have we seen in terms of the differences in distribution? What we've done now is we've been able to break this out into warmer periods versus colder periods to see if there have been any changes. So what you see here is a average catch per unit effort at the stations that we've occupied. The darker regions show higher catch per unit effort, meaning that this is where fish are distributed. And I think it's pretty easy to see that in what we consider to be the warmer years in the northern Bering Sea up here, here's the Yukon River, This is Norton Sound. That a lot of the fish that we caught were actually distributed in this area all the way up into the Bering Strait. One of the other things I want to point out here is that we actually were able to catch juvenile Chinook salmon in the southeastern Bering Sea, and there's been high concentrations off of what would be the Kuskokwim and then probably the Nooshigak area. So in contrast to that, when it really started getting colder, we've seen a shift in the distribution of the juvenile Chinook salmon off the Yukon down south, just north. This is Nunavak Island. And this has been maintained even this year. I know Katie Howard was out on the survey, and when we were getting information back on catch period effort for juvenile Chinook, that was the area that they started to catch them in again. And then the other thing I want to point out is the absence of data from down here. We haven't caught many juvenile Chinook salmon in the colder years in the southeastern Bering Sea, and what we think is going on is that it's cold, they're not growing as fast, and so they're not getting offshore as far, and we're not able to get them with our gear because we're sampling the further offshore. So as Phil pointed out, there was a really good relationship between the abundance index of the juvenile Chinook of pink salmon in southeast Alaska with those that returned 1 year later. So was this true then for other species of salmon in different regions of the North Pacific? Bill Templin talked yesterday about genetics. Well, we're actually getting the stock structure of the juvenile salmon that we're collecting out there, and here's an example of proportions of the Canadian origin juvenile Chinook salmon within the survey that we've been conducting. And this is a relative index of abundance that's been, so you can see that we've had some real changes and variability in the relative index over the years. You can see there's an absent data point in 2008. That was a year we didn't have funding to do research in the Northern Bering Sea, but that was restored in 2009 all the way through present. So can we take these data then and actually look and see if they're a good predictor of adult returns? And again, pink salmon return the next year, but Chinook salmon are out there in the ocean for 3 and 4 more years after our survey. And so because of that, we've only got about 5 data points that we can actually look at. And it appears from the information that we have for this limited data set that there's a decent relationship there between the relative abundance of the Canadian origin Chinook and those that return as adults 3, 4, and 5 years later. And as Phil pointed out, that suggests half a critical period. So what we're thinking then is that these fish are fit because we're out there again right before the first winter at sea, and that the mortality events that are probably going on here are happening before our survey. Not that there isn't mortality going on after the survey, but with this fit that we see here, we believe it's that more of the mortality is happening prior to the survey. So what evidence do we have that suggests that these fish are fit? Jim Murphy just put this slide together about a week ago, and I think this is a really good way to look at probability of surviving for juvenile salmon in the ocean. And how this was constructed is this line here is the size of surviving juvenile salmon. So where did we get that information from? Well, we collected it from adult scales. So these are fish that were adults that survived, and we were able to take the scale, get the information off of it, go back in time off that scale because the scales are like they have rings on them, they're growth patterns. We can go back to the juvenile life history stage, and then we can look at what the size of that fish was that survived. And this is, of course, there's a range here because we have a number of fish that we looked at over a number of years. And then we can, what that gives us then is a probability of survival by length. And so this is, I don't know if you can see it there, this is about the probability at 50%. So if you're above 200 millimeters, you have a greater than 50% chance of surviving to adulthood as a juvenile. And what you're seeing with the length frequency here is the juvenile population that we've sampled over the last few years. It's the whole data set put together. And I think it's pretty clear that most of these fish are reaching 200 and above. And so it appears, at least from this example here, that these fish are achieving a good size prior to the first winter at sea and have a good chance of surviving. The other way we can look at this again, remember we want to look at energy. Or do they have are they fit enough to make it through winter? Do they have enough fat? Energy is a proxy for lipid, which is a fat content of the fish, and we know that there's a real strong relationship between the amount of energy a fish has and the size of the fish. So bigger fish have more energy. And if you think that energy should be a good predictor then for marine survival, we don't see a really good fit here with the limited data set that we have for Chinook. And again, one of the observations that this, one of the things is that this suggests is that these fish are fit. They attained good energy. There's no, so we don't see anything, any relationship with marine survival. So fish are big, at least at the time that we're sampling them, and they seem to be fairly fit. And this is for juvenile Chinook. And why are these fish fit? Well, they're eating very high quality prey. And that seems to be fairly consistent between years when it's warm and years when it's cold. Most often they're eating capelin and sandlance. These are high packets of energy. Again, in the colder years, there's more proportion in the diet was capelin, and that's because our survey also tells us that the capelin abundance was increasing at that time. So we are actually capturing the prey of these fish with the same sampling gear that we're capturing the predator, which is the Chinook. Okay, I'm going to move on to another example now. This is taking you into the southeastern Bering Sea, and I know this isn't Chinook, but it's Bristol Bay sockeye salmon, and we have similar information that we can show here, and we can compare and contrast what we're seeing between these two regions. For juvenile sockeye salmon, we see similar changes in distribution between warm and cold years. So I've just put this as an average. The warm years, again, 2002 through 5. Cold years were those years from 6 through 9, I believe, for this publication. But I think you can see there's real change. The juvenile sockeye salmon, again, these are from Bristol Bay area, are broadly distributed across the southeastern Bering Sea shelf during these warm years, whereas during the cold years, they get constricted back up into Bristol Bay and down along the Alaska Peninsula. And that's comforting because of the survey that was happening back in the early 70s by Strady also found that the juvenile sockeye salmon, these were very cold years in the early 70s, that the juvenile sockeye salmon in their survey were in this same area. So we confirmed that, but we also showed that because we were able to capture a warm period, that there were real changes in what occurs for these salmon depending on what's going on in the environment. So we also collect relative abundance then from our juvenile sockeye salmon. I think you can see that there's a couple of real big juvenile abundance years that occurred in 2005. In 2007, I want you to remember these 2 years. These are, in a relative sense, you know, roughly 350 to 400 million fish out there, and that's a lot of fish compared to what we've seen in other years. One of the things that we can note is that there appears to be sort of a decline in our index, and that's been sustained all the way through 2011. But can we use these data to predict future returns of sockeye salmon? We really don't see a real good fit there. So here's a whole different story. And that suggests to us that the mortality after the survey is pretty high on these fish, and there's got to be a reason for that. And so, again, these are those two big years that seem to pull away from the fit. But then, again, if we were to take these out, there seems to be just a shotgun blast of data there with no real good relationship. So what's happening with sockeye salmon compared to what was going on with Chinook up in the northern Bering Sea? There's a lot of information here that essentially our Russian colleagues had a survey in winter of 2009. They did a survey south of the Aleutian chain. They captured ocean age one sockeye salmon during that survey. That was important to us. We were able to get that information from them. We were able to collect samples from them because we wanted to be able to compare that information on size from the survey that occurred in winter with the information on size that we had on the same fish in fall. And so you're probably saying, how do we know those were the same fish? Well, again, we did a genetic analysis on the samples that were collected in winter by our Russian colleagues, and about 60% of those fish that were captured south of the Aleutian chain were from Bristol Bay. So a real quick analysis on just looking at size frequencies for surviving fish that made it through the winter versus those that we caught in the fall indicated to us that there's a pretty big size selective mortality that's going on after our survey. Again, size is important for sockeye before winter. We're also seeing that there's a strong relationship between length or size of sockeye salmon. These are juveniles with the energy that they obtain over the first summer at sea. But again, if you look at the slope and the intercept of those lines that are fit through the various years, you see changes. And so, you know, a fish that might have an energetic status at 200 millimeters in 1 year might have a significantly different energetic status in another year. And that's essentially based on prey quality and quantity, what the ecosystem's producing for them to grow and gain energy from. And here's an interesting slide that we just put together. This is the baseline energetic status of ocean age one, I should say, sockeye salmon that actually survived winter. This is from our Russian survey. And confidence intervals around that, and then taking it back a step back to look at what our juvenile salmon energies were prior to the first winter at sea. And you can see that fish that were out there, although they were quite abundant in 2005 and 2007, they weren't very fit, energetically fit prior to going into that winter. And so there was, like, obviously some pretty high mortality going on over winter for those fish. Now, that didn't mean disastrous returns, because there were a lot of fish out there, but there was a lot of mortality on those fish, and it was energy and size related. And what were these fish feeding on then in those years? In the warm years, believe it or not, sockeye salmon fed quite heavily on age zero pollock. And when we got into the colder years, they started eating more zooplankton, euphausids, and other things. So we saw a real change in their diet. And we note from publications that are coming out that the pollock that they were feeding on in those warm years were not energetically fit. And just to give you an example of overwinter survival based on fitness, this is the pollock relationship. This is total energy for age zero pollock. This is the warm years when they weren't very fit. Since then, it's gotten colder. The prey in the environment has changed. The pollock, those age zero pollock, have gotten more fit. And there's a strong relationship between just their energy and recruitment to age one, indicating that pollock have that fitness is related to overwinter survival. Taking that back then to looking at our juvenile sockeye salmon and relating energy to marine survival index, just based on the juveniles, this is adult marine survival to adult, we can see just the juvenile energy has a pretty good fit with the limited data set that we have. So that offers some promise to suggest that this overwinter hypothesis is real for sockeye. So in conclusion, I want to say that the juvenile surveys and research on marine ecological processes impacting survival can improve our understanding of linkages between salmon production and climate. And I think that the next step for us for gap analysis is to model this information. We have a lot of data, and we need to put this in a modeling context that can connect climate to growth rate potential and then to survival for these salmon. And a lot of money has gone into doing research connecting physics to fish in the Bering Sea, as Phil Mundy pointed out, through the Bering Sea Integrated Ecosystem Research Program. So we now have a climate model from that research. We have a model that gives us nutrients, phytoplankton, zooplankton data by bin and time on the eastern Bering Sea shelf. What we need to do next, of course, for Chinook is that we need to find out how that affects some of these prey, the capelin and the sand lance. And with that information, I know this is a lot of going through a lot of concepts, but with that prey information, we can get a growth rate potential for Chinook through modeling of bioenergetics. And what you need to know then is just the biomass and the prey quality for their prey. And from there, that leads us to, from that growth, we can connect that through time and lead to a probability of a fish surviving. But once we get that probability of survival from all this information, we also need to know how many fish were out there. And I think a smolt, we need to have smolt information to see what's coming out into the marine environment and then run a model to see just exactly what survived and see if that's working for us. Another gap that I see for Chinook salmon in the Yukon is that, is that early marine period, that first critical period that we don't have a lot of information on, and we believe this is where a lot of the mortality is occurring. And so a survey at that time period would be very important and help inform this model that I think would be important for us to do. And again, we need more information on this the Kuskokwim and the Nooshigak, you know, what's happening down there. Our survey did find those fish in the warm years, but in the cold years we didn't see them in our survey, so we can't say much about them. Thank you.
We have time for a couple quick questions. Jim.
Hello, this is Jim Murphy with NOAA Fisheries, and Ed, you've contrasted kind of two different patterns with Chinook and sockeye. And I'm wondering if you could kind of speak to those differences as being kind of more of a species level difference, or if it might be the region, northern Bering versus southern Bering.
Obviously, there's a difference in the species. They're eating different prey, but one of the things that this Bering Sea Integrated Ecosystem Research Program produced is a new hypothesis for us to look at. And this is a simplistic saying for this, but it's same Arctic changing southeastern Bering Sea. Of course, that's related to ice. And I think that you saw that for Chinook, their diets were primarily capelin and sand lance, and that really didn't change over time, where we saw big changes in the southeastern Bering Sea. And the physical oceanographers tell us that through the climate models, ice is going to be present in the northeastern Bering Sea for quite some time. And even when it gets warm, the ice edge pretty much extends down to 60 north, keeping that productivity in the northern Bering Sea more ice-driven than the southern Bering Sea. And so the real shifting is going on in the southeastern Bering Sea, where you have changes in ice extent and duration in winter and spring. And when it warms up, we see real changes going on in the southeastern Bering Sea in consideration to the ecosystem processes, the different prey that we're seeing out there, what fish are feeding on, and their fitness, which also could translate into differences between Nooshigak and Kuskokwim Chinook versus those in the Yukon, because those fish are actually in the southeastern Bering Sea, which is highly variable, I should say, in depending on ice.
Hi, this is Jim Ionelli with the Alaska Center. I was just wondering on the vertical distribution of the animals, is there much differences, and can the gear sample different depths for locations? Just wondering if there was changes in warm and cold years.
That's a good question. And we have acoustic information that started in 2006. I can't address the warm years, but during 2006 all the way to present, we've actually included acoustics in our survey and midwater trawls. So we've had surface trawls and midwater trawling going on. And we don't catch salmon below the surface waters. And so there's a very consistent pattern in the 5 years we've been out doing midwater trawls where we don't see salmon below surface, at least below 25 meters. And if you're thinking about where Chinook salmon are distributed, these near coastal areas are pretty shallow. It's less than 50 meters deep, which we're sampling most of that water column in that area with our gear.
Bill Hurd, NOAA Fisheries. Ed, you mentioned that in the cold years, you're catching few juvenile Chinook in the southeastern Bering Sea, in contrast to the warm years, and suggested they may be growing slowly and remaining inshore. So does this raise the question that we need some additional types of sampling in a closer to shore area to study those fish?
Yes, and as I said in the conclusion, in order for us to understand what's going on with these fish in the southeastern Bering Sea, we need to get further near shore and have near shore surveys. And it's going to be a different sampling design and a different sampling gear.